This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
You're listening to Soundside from KUOW. I'm Zeki Hamid. For a lot of us, there's a book from our childhood or adolescence that just sticks in our memory. There's something about the characters or the story that we can't seem to forget. For Rick Emerson, that book was Go Ask Alice. Published in 1971, the book follows a teenage girl who develops a substance addiction. The book then became a bestseller, selling over 5 million copies, and it has never gone out of print. Emerson still remembers the first time he saw the book in his school library.
I just saw the cover, and the cover is this sort of kind of spooky image of this this girl with her face in half shadow. And I saw those eight words, and it's, Go Ask Alice, A Real Diary by Anonymous. And I thought, well, I got to read this. And I checked it out. I think I read it twice back to back. It really unsettled me in a deep way, which I think happened to a lot of people.
For decades, a question about Go Ask Alice haunted Emerson. Who was the author behind the anonymous byline on the cover of the book? Emerson's new book, Alice Unmasked, LSD, Satanic Panic, and the Imposter Behind the World's Most Notorious Diaries, takes a deeper look into the woman who presented herself as the editor of Go Ask Alice, and the impacts the book has had on America's understanding of drug addiction and mental illness. I started my conversation with Rick by asking him how Go Ask Alice impacted him and his peers.
I think this is probably all intensified pre-internet when there was, you know, really word of mouth and what the book itself said. Those were the only things you had to go on. And, you know, you start with the idea that it says a real diary on the front. And that's something that, you know, that's obviously the idea of reading somebody else's diary is so deeply taboo. It's one of those things that, you know, you're never supposed to do. You're never supposed to read somebody else's private journal. And so the fact that there was this book that was presumably the way it was marketed anyway, it was supposedly someone's real diary, and that you were not being told that you could read it. You were actually being told that you should read it, that it was this thing that was printed exactly so you could read it. And so there was a, you know, there was sort of an illicit thrill to that. And also, you know, the fact, frankly, that the supposed diarist was dead, you know, that adds a sort of strange dramatic undercurrent to it. And of course, the fact that it's credited to Anonymous, that's one of those things that even now, today, when a book comes out and it's credited to Anonymous, you're immediately intrigued by it because there's this mystique, there's this mystery to it. All of that coupled with the fact that, you know, the diarist, you know, that everybody, we all ended up calling her Alice, that she herself was a teenager. It was impossible to not be intrigued and unnerved by that book.
Do you think that it brought you away from doing drugs, trying drugs, anything like that? Did it scare you?
It definitely had some frightening elements to it, even now. And so Go Ask Alice has been out for 51 years at this point, and is, you know, they put out a 50th anniversary edition last year. It's still a big seller. And even today, there are sections of Go Ask Alice that are horrifying, that are, you know, deeply, deeply frightening or revolting in a way that, you know, there's a lot of really graphic descriptions of things that happened to her or things that she, you know, hallucinates while she's either under the influence of drugs or while she's detoxing. For me, I was already pretty straight-laced. You know, I came from a family that had its share of addiction issues and substance abuse issues. And so I was already predisposed to avoid those things. But Go Ask Alice definitely reinforced that. I do know that I'm not alone in that regard. There are a lot of people who read Go Ask Alice and either got clean and sober because of that book or who stayed clean and sober because of that book. At the same time, Go Ask Alice has a very complicated legacy because while it did keep some people away from drugs and alcohol, that's indisputable. You know, it also gave people a lot of false impressions of what drugs were like and what they did and the relative dangers of different drugs. For one thing, Go Ask Alice kind of puts marijuana and LSD and heroin sort of into one big basket and portrays them as equally lethal and equally addictive. And, you know, if you read that when you're a teenager and then you get a little bit older and you find out that that's not necessarily so, you know, that can really undermine a lot of the other messages you've heard about drugs.
That's a good point. So I want to get into your book about this, Unmask Alice. And your book makes it pretty clear that you can't begin to understand who the real person behind these diaries is without understanding the woman who presented herself as the editor of the diary, Beatrice Sparks. So can you tell us a little bit about Beatrice and who she was?
Yeah, Beatrice Sparks was, she's the woman behind Go Ask Alice and several other anonymous teenage diaries. She was a deeply conservative Latter-day Saint and a mother of four. And by her account, she discovered and edited the diaries, Go Ask Alice, as you mentioned, and later a sort of sibling book called Jay's Journal and a half dozen others, all of which supposedly came from real teenagers. And as you noted, she always presented herself as merely being the editor of these diaries, then that she was presenting them as a public service to help kids and to help families.
So fans and critics of Go Ask Alice have debated for decades about the authenticity of the diary and who it was supposedly based on, and Beatrice Sparks' actual role in getting the diary published. But until your book, it mostly just stayed at that, a debate. So I'm wondering, why did you want to dig into the myth that surrounds this supposed memoir?
I think it made such an impact on me when I was a teenager, and the idea that it was credited to Anonymous, which is, you know, sort of tantalizing in several ways, because the idea that it's, you know, if it's anonymous and so it's, if it's credited to no one in particular, then it could be anyone. And, you know, that Alice could be a person from anywhere. You really don't know. And so there's just this intriguing aspect to that of, well, who is this person really? And it's a book that I assumed had already been written. I guess that's maybe the short answer, is that I thought that somebody had to have told the story by now, because it's such, you know, certainly in the United States, it had such a big impact and was so widely known, so much so that even a lot of people who've never read it or have never heard of it have been influenced by it. You know, whenever you watch a television show, like let's say Euphoria, you watch any sort of a movie that's about, you know, youth today making terrible choices, you know, whenever there's some sort of something in popular culture about teenagers who are engaging in, you know, risky behavior, those are all in some way influenced by Go Ask Alice. And I remember reading it the first time and asking a friend of mine about it. And I said, well, who's this anonymous? And she said, well, nobody knows, silly. That's why it's anonymous. And I thought, how can nobody know? How can nobody know this? And I think the second part is that I lived through two different social panics. One was the war on drugs, and not just the war on drugs, but the 1980s era war on drugs, which was the just say no era, where we were told that there was someone lurking around every corner waiting to slip LSD into our food or into our soda. And then a few years later, the satanic panic, which was this, you know, literal 15-year witch hunt that spread across the country, kind of destroying lives left and right. And what I didn't know at the time was that both of those social panics, they were both linked to a teenage diary. And when I learned that both of those diaries came from, as you said, the same place, they both came from this giant house with blood red walls on the outskirts of Provo, Utah. And once I learned that and that nobody had really delved into it, I just sort of became a thing that took over my life for half dozen years.
Yeah. So I want to go back to a point that you made about the impact of this. So critics of Go Ask Alice have pointed out that its portrayal of addiction contributed to a larger disinformation campaign around drugs that started in the 70s. The main character's first experience with drugs is by accidentally drinking a soda spiked with LSD. Then 2 days later, she's experimenting with heroin, and a year later, she's dead. So what impact, if you can talk a little bit more about that, what impact did Go Ask Alice have on Americans' understanding of drug use and addiction?
For one thing, Go Ask Alice really helped to crystallize, for adults certainly, the idea of LSD spiking. In other words, it became the sort of platonic ideal of that experience, just like, you know, sort of Jaws gave us the image of the single dorsal fin above the water, and The Exorcist gave us the idea of a girl's head turning 360 degrees. Go Ask Alice gave us the image of a soda laced with LSD, and for a lot of people, that became, it was emblematic of this larger issue, so much so that in 1972, Richard Nixon and his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, actually referenced that in the Oval Office while talking about drugs. And it, as you noted, takes something that is, it's almost a reverse timeline of drug use. The idea that she starts with LSD and is shooting up and is taking all manner of drugs before finally ending at marijuana, which is, you know, just not, that's not representative of how that usually goes. And it doesn't draw a lot of distinctions between different substances and how addictive or how dangerous they are. And especially at that time, Americans and American adults in particular were really looking for answers, because in 1970, 800,000 Americans took LSD for the first time, which was the most ever at that point. And it had only been illegal for a few years, but the numbers were still going up every single year. And LSD had already been tied into a lot of other things in the culture, always in a very, very negative, notorious way. And, you know, in the, you know, the Charles Manson, you know, both sides of the, in the Manson case said, pointed at LSD as the reason that he was able to brainwash these girls. And so for a lot of people who were looking for answers, who felt isolated and cut off from their kids, Go Ask Alice presented what seemed to be this plausible real life scenario of how drug abuse escalates. And absent any other hard information, a lot of people grabbed that and used that as a definitive example.
Yeah, and that came out after the whole Ken Kesey thing, experimentation with LSD as well.
Absolutely. And for people who only had a theoretical understanding of that, or it was only something they'd maybe read about in a newspaper or in a magazine article, this especially being marketed as the real diary of a real girl who really lived and died, you know, people just took it as gospel truth.
So you also investigate another story, which you did allude to earlier, another story that Beatrice Sparks published in 1978, and that book was called Jay's Journal. So to me, it seems that book is a little bit more insidious than Go Ask Alice because of the way it was published. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, so Go Ask Alice came out in 1971, and then 8 years later, the sibling book called Jay's Journal came out, and Jay's Journal is another posthumous teenage diary. And it is about a teenage boy who gets lured into black magic, into devil worship, and eventually dies at 16. And just as with Go Ask Alice, the backstory was that, well, he left behind his diary. And so in this edited form, it's being published as a way to help other teenagers and other families avoid this same terrible fate. And one of the things that it did is it helped to arguably helped to unleash and definitely helped to fuel the satanic panic. The other thing that you just alluded to with Jay's Journal is that there is absolutely a real person at the core of Jay's Journal. There's a teenager named Alden who had diary entries that ended up in that book. It contains several dozen of his actual journal entries, but they're presented and framed in a way that really gives a false impression of him. It really distorts who he was and did quite a lot to tarnish his memory and his legacy and to cause a lot of trouble for his family and in his community.
Yeah, and I think I read that when that book was published, it came as a surprise to Alden's mother. Is that correct?
In a sense, the story, and I should say at the outset, the story is just unbelievable. It is every time, I mean, one of the reasons this book took me so long to write is because every time I thought the story had gotten as big and as unbelievable as I thought it could get, I was always proven wrong because it got bigger and stranger. So in the aftermath of Go Ask Alice, as you noted, Beatrice Sparks had at one point a few years later had sort of outed herself as the alleged editor, as the woman who had edited these diaries into this book. And Marcella Barrett, whose son had committed suicide, he had suffered from addiction and he'd suffered from depression. And so he had taken his life and left behind a diary. And his mother read an interview with Beatrice Sparks where she identified herself as the editor of Go Ask Alice. And Alden's mother thought, ah, okay, this woman can help me. She can help me edit my son's diaries and help present them as, you know, to other people so that other families can learn how to deal with depression and mental illness and addiction with their children. So she gave a copy of his diary to Beatrice Sparks. And when the book came out, it did catch her by surprise because she wasn't given any warning. And when the book did come out, it was a very, very, very distorted picture of Alden. He had been turned into someone unrecognizable and unspeakable. And so that family got ambushed in several ways. Yeah.
So it seems to me that both of these books corresponded with common fears in American society, right? When Go Ask Alice was published, the fear was drugs. When Jay's Journal was published, it was Satanism. So do you think it's a coincidence that they were published when they were, or was Beatrice Sparks just a huckster? I guess I'm really wondering if there is more to Beatrice Sparks than what I'm seeing at the surface.
I think on some level she had, it's hard to call it good timing, because, you know, the fallout from those books was just, was so destructive in so many ways. But, you know, from her perspective, you know, it really was, the timing was fortuitous in the sense that there were two books that society was really primed for. As you noted, Go Ask Alice came out in 1971 when the public fears over LSD, especially LSD as it related to consumption by teenagers, was, you know, was really, it was epidemic. Everybody was worried about that. 8 years later, in 1979, there had been bubbling underneath the surface a couple of things. One was this growing fear of, I think, what at the time would have been called, New Age religions, or, you know, religions that were not rooted, you know, in quote, traditional American values, which is its own kind of dog whistle, obviously. And Jonestown had happened. And so there was all of this fear of cults. Cult was probably the word that they used the most. And cult was used pretty, that was a pretty broad term that was used to apply to anything that, you know, anything that didn't seem like it was, you know, rooted in this sort of idealized 50s version of America. And the bigger problem, though, was teenage suicide. Teenage suicide rates had been rising for many, many years, and especially among young men. And as with the drug use, there was a lot of panic over, how do we explain this? What is the cause of this? How do we untangle this problem and stop it? And humans are, and I'm including myself in this, I think we are hardwired for simple solutions and to look for simple answers, especially to complicated, awkward problems. And that can lead decent, intelligent people to believe unbelievable, irrational, destructive things, including the idea of a massive nationwide conspiracy of Satanists and that they are attempting to lure your children. And Jay's Journal presented this, you know, this very simple explanation for a very daunting, complicated problem. And that was appealing to a lot of people.
Right, exactly. We do love simple answers in America, that's for sure. It's a lot easier. You know, as you and other critics have pointed out, Go Ask Alice and Jay's Journal are sensational, over the top. But given where American society was in the 1970s, do you think that the public would have actually accepted and bought a real diary from a teenager dealing with substance abuse or mental illness?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the missed opportunities, certainly with Jay's Journal and with Go Ask Alice, the idea that if it had been presented straightforwardly, and the fact is that those cases certainly existed. There had been not just the issue of drugs, but in the years leading up to Go Ask Alice, the number of teenage runaways had really skyrocketed. And it wasn't just that the number of runaways had drastically increased, it was that they were increasingly teenagers and teenage girls. And so young women had become, you know, they had started running away from home in record numbers. So there was certainly, the material existed because those cases were everywhere. There was no need to fabricate anything. You know, Go Ask Alice, for all of the people who have connected with that book and for some of the good that it has done in keeping people, clean and sober, or helping them to sober up, because that's certainly true. It also has undone its own good works sometimes, as you said, by being so unbelievable at points and being so melodramatic and so over the top in a way that the simple truth just wouldn't. You know, the truth sounds different and the truth resonates in a way that nothing else does. And I think that that was really a missed opportunity just to say, this is what it's really like.
I'm trying to figure out the legacy of these books. Now, we talked about simple answers earlier, and maybe there isn't a simple answer or even a simple legacy to these books, but is harm a big part of the legacy of Go Ask Alice?
I think Go Ask Alice in particular does have a very complex legacy, in the sense that, you know, as I noted earlier, that there are definitely people. I mean, Go Ask Alice has saved lives. There's just no way around that fact, because there are people. I interviewed several people toward the end of this book. In fact, one of the people I speak with toward the end is a young woman named Morgan, who, she discovered Go Ask Alice in 2010, I believe, when she was 12 years old. I think she was born in 98, and I think she discovered Go Ask Alice in 2010. So that's long after the internet, long after doubts had been raised about whether it was real. But she read Go Ask Alice when she was 12, and to this day has remained clean and sober, which is especially impressive because she does come from a family where there's a lot of substance abuse. So it has definitely helped some people. At the same time, it does have its own tangled legacy of sowing a lot of distrust and giving people a lot of misinformation. You know, I'm a big proponent of the idea that the world needs more books, not fewer books. I think with Go Ask Alice in particular and Jay's journal, I think it's more an issue of labeling and it's an issue of how you present it. And do you present something that is fictional as nonfiction? And if so, what's the damage of that? What's the fallout from calling something true when it's a lie? You don't have to look too far. I hesitate to make everything about the last several years in this country, but you don't have to look too far to see the ramifications and the fallout of undermining people's idea of truth. That really, that has a lot of ongoing malignant effects. And so I think it's more about how you present it and it's more about how you label it and not calling something true when it's not.
Rick, Go Ask Alice has had a tremendous impact on young adult genre, as you mentioned before. As of July 2022, over 5 million copies have been sold. If you go to Amazon today, you're going to see thousands of reviews from people saying that Alice sparked their love of reading and impacted their life in one way or another. So I'm wondering how other people's connection to this book and what it's meant to them complicated your own feelings about Beatrice Spark's manipulation of the readers and the publishing industry.
It's an interesting question because one of the reasons I think that Go Ask Alice continues to be such a force in the culture and in young adult, in the young adult genre, and one of the reasons why it is still widely read now is that it's interesting. There's a sort of a dichotomy with Go Ask Alice in particular that when adults read Go Ask Alice, they tend to fixate on the events. In other words, they are looking at, oh, this girl does drugs. She has sex. She runs away from home. They're looking at what happens, at the actual choices she makes. Young people who read Go Ask Alice tend to identify with the girl herself. In other words, adults read Go Ask Alice and they say, I cannot believe all the terrible, destructive choices this girl is making. Young people read Go Ask Alice and they, I'm generalizing here, but young people tend to read Go Ask Alice and say, this girl, I identify with her. She feels the way I feel. You know, Alice feels like a misfit and she feels like she doesn't have the right friends and she doesn't always feel like she has the right clothes and she doesn't feel like she's fitting in and she feels, you know, that her parents don't understand her and that she doesn't quite know what she wants to do with her life. And, you know, when you are, I mean, it's been a long time since I was a teenager, but when you're an adolescent, there's this strange thing that happens when you're a teenager where you simultaneously feel like you are losing your mind and that you are the only sane person on the planet. And there's also no middle ground with your mood most of the time. You know, if people remember back to when they were teenagers, every day is either, you know, the greatest moment of your life or it's the end of the world. There's not a whole lot of middle ground. And Go Ask Alice really captures that. I sometimes compare it to the Stephen King book, Carrie, which continues to also be incredibly popular with readers of all ages, including teenagers. And it's people identify with Carrie White, not because they have telekinetic abilities, but because Carrie White feels like, she feels like a misfit and she feels like someone who has all this inner tumult and this emotional turmoil. And that's what they identify with. The other stuff is just window dressing. It's the same with Go Ask Alice. I think that's the reason why Go Ask Alice continues to be popular is that however false and, you know, or, exaggerated a lot of the events are and a lot of the specific plot developments are, emotionally, it rings true. It captures that moment of frazzled, hyperkinetic, ultra-emotional tumult that you feel a lot of times when you're a teenager. And that's what people continue to connect with. That's one of the reasons why I think it endures.
Yeah. One last question here. Are there any books that you would recommend as a more accurate portrayal of drug addiction for young adult readers? Something that would maybe take Alice's spot?
That is a really good question. In a strange way, I'm probably not qualified to make that recommendation only because I've been so submerged in the world of Go Ask Alice for a long time. But I will say that this is an opportunity for me to do something that I never tire of, which is to sing the praises of libraries and librarians. That is absolutely a place where you can, you know, you can go find a librarian and, you know, say, look, this is what I'm trying to read for myself or for somebody I know or for my, you know, for my own teenager, because we have learned, you know, so much more. Mental health and addiction science, all of those things, treatment, those have all grown by leaps and bounds in the 50 years since Go Ask Alice came out. You know, when Go Ask Alice was first printed, the very first study, the very first true study on teenage mental health was only 6 months old, and there was only one of those studies. So we knew almost nothing about teenage mental health and depression compared to now. So the good news is that those resources definitely exist. And so, you know, libraries are always a good place to start.
That is an excellent way to end this conversation, by telling people to go to libraries, talk to librarians, which are really heroes of American democracy. I agree with you. Rick Emerson is the author of Unmask Alice, LSD, Satanic Panic, and the Imposter Behind the World's Most Notorious Diaries. Rick, thank you so much for being here today. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We wanted to hear from a professional who works with young adults in supporting their recovery from substance use disorders. Can pieces of media like Go Ask Alice or Euphoria, which is a show on HBO, still be helpful for someone in recovery, even if its depiction of addiction may be flawed? Soundside producer Noel Gasca talked to Sydney Chaffetz, the Assistant Director of Student Development Programs for Safe Campuses. Chaffetz also has worked on college campuses like Gonzaga University.
I think that we are still trying to find ways that accurately talk about addiction and that do a good job at breaking down the stigma and reducing the biases and the barriers that prevent someone from entering into recovery. So in the work that I've done with college students over the past 6 years, so many students are hesitant to learning more about addiction, discerning whether addiction is a part of their reality, getting treatment for a substance use disorder because of what they've seen in the media. We've all had this idea in our head of what treatment for a substance use disorder looks like. Everyone's sitting around in a room and talking about their names, or giving their names and talking about their experience. And whereas that is one way in which folks can choose to recover, there are so many resources and pathways in which people can recover. It's also important to note that when young people see narratives of what addiction looks like, they're often seeing it from this lens of Go Ask Alice or of Euphoria. And then they're comparing their situation to that situation without noting that these situations have been intentionally dramatized by Hollywood to look good on the TV. So they're comparing what their misuse of alcohol or any substance might look like to that that they're seeing on the TV. And then they're not necessarily aware of the fact that addiction happens among a spectrum. So I really do think that the historical ways, whether it be in literature or in media, create a false narrative of what addiction looks like and what people that may have experiencing a substance use disorder are like. And it not only prevents people from entering into treatment or getting further resources, it also vastly accelerates this stigma and bias that already exists for people that might be in active addiction or might be in recovery from their substance use disorder.
That was Noel Gasca talking to Sydney Chaffetz, the Assistant Director of Student Development Programs for Safe Campuses. If you or someone you know is in need or of help for a substance use disorder, you can call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration hotline at 1-800-622-4357. That's 1-800-622-4357. Thanks for listening to Soundside. Don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime right here online at KUOW.org or on your favorite podcast app.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's Teen Dance Ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.